This is the Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner, the podcast for anyone supporting a pregnant woman to achieve her dream birth. I'm Sally Ann Beresford, a doula, author, and antenatal teacher, and throughout these episodes, I will be sharing with you tried and tested tips that help you to ensure that any birth you attend is a positive experience. And welcome to this week's episode of The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Professor Amy Brown today, who is a psychologist that works in public health within maternity care and author to many, many books. Her latest book, COVID Babies, was just released last week. So welcome to the podcast, Amy. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, so I'm a professor of maternal and child health at Swansea University, which is my official job. There I lead a MSc in child public health, which examines really all the early experiences and influences on child health. So pregnancy, birth, that postnatal period, and older children as well a little bit. And then I'm a director of a research centre. So our research centre is called LIFT, which stands for lactation, infant feeding and translation, which is basically just a buzzword that says we do the stuff that matters to people in the real world. So we try to do research that is relevant to parents and professionals and policymakers and those who support parents. So all my research as an academic is around really the postnatal period mainly. So it's around infant feeding, it's around mental health, it's around early parenting experiences, but it also goes to birth and pregnancy and how that all affects those later experiences and particularly maternal mental health. So it's really well-being and how all those elements of the postnatal period fit together, so baby behavior and sleep and feeding and how that affects new parents. So as part of that as well, I am an author to I think we're going to say 10. I think we added up and it was 10. I've kind of lost track. I've got to that stage. So 10 books that are all about those topics. Some of them are aimed at parents directly in trying to help them support their mental health, feed their baby, supporting them through the first year. And others are more kind of in-depth exploration of topics in the area, so all the research behind it. So we've got Breastfeeding Uncovered, which is about all the different influences on infant feeding experiences. And we've got Informed is Best, which is trying to support parents and professionals to better understand research evidence and how it's used and how it's misused and funding in research and bias and how to tell whether a headline you see in the news is actually truthful or whether it's a complete, you know, lie or complete misinterpretation of everything. And then that brings us to COVID Babies, which kind of spans the kind of two types of books. So it's all about trying to make sure parents feel validated and supported about their experiences they've had of pregnancy, birth and caring for a baby during the pandemic, but also brings together all the research that has been done on the subject that's really explored how it's hit parental mental health, how it affected birth experiences and care during pregnancy, infant feeding, mental health in the postnatal period, all of those topics. I think that's probably just about a good sum up of who I am. I have a website with all of this on. So my website is continually a work in progress because I set it up. And it's a bit like, you know, the time where you manage to get all your washing clean and you've got a kind of empty washing basket. So every now and again, my website is really up to date because I try to get on it all my research papers, any kind of free to watch presentation that I've done or podcast or live or article that I've written and all my books and everything. And obviously I get it up to date and then something else happens and we get back to square one of having to update it again. But it's professoramybrown.co.uk if you want to find out more, because it's got everything on there, or almost everything.
It is an excellent resource. I point people to it all the time. So it is fantastic. I would really like to find out how you became interested in maternity care. Is that something that you've always done, or did you end up coming into that for a different reason?
I think I came into it for a really common reason, that I had my own babies and suddenly realised a load of things that you don't realise until you have your own babies. So you just don't realise that these experiences are happening, or even that these different experiences exist. So I have to say, until I was pregnant with my first baby, I kind of had no clue about feeding babies. I thought you just like breast or formula fed them and it was really simple and you just got on with it. I thought you always had to go into a hospital to give birth and it was all very serious. I had no clue about any of those topics. And so I did a undergraduate degree in psychology and I did a master's degree in research. And then I signed up to do a PhD about something else entirely. It was meant to be about older children and eating behavior and something along the lines of, you're not meant to bribe them with food because that will make them emotional eaters. So you should never, you know, bribe them with an ice cream or reward them with food. Yeah. The naivety, you know, of somebody who didn't have children at that point. And the kind of almost amusing part of this story is, when I did my undergraduate psychology degree, I really wanted to be a clinical psychologist. I really wanted to get into mental health support. But because I quite absorb people's emotions and I really kind of feel their distress and their emotions, I thought, oh, this is going to be too much for me. I'm going to be permanently sort of on edge with all these kind of emotions floating around. So I thought, I can't possibly go into that. I'll go into research. And somehow kind of naturally ended up researching maternity care experiences and postnatal care experiences, which, of course, is probably even more emotive than being a clinical psychologist, because you've got all this grief and challenging experiences that parents have and you can't necessarily directly help them. So I always think it's amusing that I wanted a career that was sort of free from emotion and ended up looking at, you know, women's experiences of birth trauma and breastfeeding trauma and all of this. So I got there when I was pregnant with my first baby. It just kind of opened my eyes to everything that went on. And I came in from a very infant feeding perspective, in that I decided to give breastfeeding a go. I found it, I always said, relatively easy. And it was kind of a state of mind, because I actually had mastitis so many times and he didn't sleep and he fed, you know, every 2 hours or so around the clock like babies do. But to me, that was quite straightforward. But it was like every single mother I met as a new mother seemed to have either have stopped breastfeeding or be finding it really difficult. And I just became fascinated as what was going on and really interested in how myths and messages around infant feeding were affecting women's ability to breastfeed. So, you know, they should sleep through the night, you should feed them to a routine, you're spoiling that baby. And it all spiraled from there, because once you start looking at infant feeding experiences, you're looking at partners and birth and mental health and postnatal care and how they just all slot together. You can't look at infant feeding or birth without considering mental health at the same time, because they just are so strongly linked. And that's where I am now. So he's 15 and a half and like 6 foot something and towering over me, and I'm still going and just still writing and trying to do the research that, you know, matters. So sometimes it's the really simple questions that we don't have research data for. So, you know, how often babies wake up at night, or how often babies feed, just to kind of start building search evidence around almost what we already know, because you sometimes need the research evidence for the policy to emerge. So yeah, I think that pretty much sums up how I got here, and I'm still here, because it's the subject that we'll never finish, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you think about pre-pregnancy, I was talking to Maddie McMahon about breastfeeding in an earlier podcast, and she was saying that, you know, we're just not witnessing it enough as children. We're not seeing it as the norm. It's very much considered to be the norm by many people, and they say, I do want to breastfeed. That is the typical viewpoint of the people I meet, I suppose. But on the whole, they see it as you put the baby to the breast and Bob's your uncle type of it. It's like, it's going to be pretty straightforward. And what you find is that as they start antenatal preparation, even on the courses they attend, it's just not covered enough. And then when they go through their birth experience and come out the other side, the support isn't there for them. That's what I see and what I witness. And I would have to say, in my experience, I see more women traumatized and grief-stricken from not being able to breastfeed than I ever do from having a difficult or negative birth experience. Would you say the same?
Oh, gosh. It's not something I don't have so much contact with women about their birth experiences. So obviously a lot of people tell me about their feeding experiences. It seems to be on the increase that women are opening up about it. So I think until a few years ago, it was almost something that got ignored, or you felt you couldn't talk about. A lot of the narrative was around, you know, if you talked about how important breastfeeding was to you, then you were making other women feel guilty or pressurizing them. And I think a lot of the dialogue was very defensive. Now we're seeing more and more women open up and say, you know what, I had a really difficult time and it was awful and I'm really sad about it. And I think it's becoming much more acceptable to actually properly talk about that. And just to remember that, you know, one person saying breastfeeding was really important to me does not mean you're saying I'm criticizing your choice to formula feed or the reasons why you're formula feeding. It's about what's important to any individual. You know, we all like different things in life. We all have different hobbies or different things that are important to us and that really distress us when we can't do them, but they're not a judgment on other people. Mm. And I think we're really at that stage where we are talking about the grief more. And you're completely right in, you know, your observations there and your experiences in that so many aren't prepared enough. And it's just that chain of reaction, isn't it? That they don't get the right information antenatally. So there are some really great antenatal preparing to breastfeeding courses out there, which are brilliant. And they focus on the reality. So they focus on things like normal baby behavior. So it's normal for your baby to feed really frequently, cluster feeding, all of that. They focus on complications and things that can go wrong, and they focus on where to get support. And that's essentially what you need. But there's too many classes that gloss over all of that. And certainly it's only been relatively recently that we've seen more and more good classes. I think historically, if you can use that word, for a few years ago, it used to all be, we were so scared about putting women off breastfeeding as if they were really weak or something and couldn't handle a bit of a challenge, that we didn't talk about all the things that could go wrong. When it's, you know, when you learn to drive, you learn about the things that can go wrong. You should learn how to change a tire and how to check the oil and things like that. And it's not saying you will have this problem, but it's saying, look, this might happen. And if you do, go and see this person or do this or do that. Because I think a lot end up not then understanding that this is solvable, and people are, you know, pressurizing them just to stop. They often think they're helping by suggesting that you start breastfeeding, but actually it erases all the reasons why someone might want to breastfeed. But then they're not being put in touch with the people who could really help them. So it is a real loss, and it does impact whole families more than we realise, because breastfeeding is not just about the milk. It's about that connection. It's about a way of caring for a baby. It can be important for religious or cultural reasons. It's about a part of your body working in the way you want it to. So that, you know, to me, whenever someone says it doesn't matter that you can't breastfeed, I just hear it doesn't matter that that part of your body doesn't work. And it's like, oh, okay. Should we not be, you know, intervening and looking at why and getting you the support that you need? So it, you know, it starts off with that lack of preparation and understanding, and going back to what Maddie said to you, it's about breastfeeding not being visible in our communities for children. So, you know, in generations where breastfeeding was normal and probably having closer connections to family was normal as well, we'd have grown up seeing breastfeeding and seeing how it worked. And I don't mean, you know, complications of latch, but I mean, you would see how often a baby fed. So you would subconsciously know that, and you would know how someone picked up a baby to feed them, and you'd see the different positions, and you'd see, you know, you just know more about the whole experience. And children aren't exposed to that. So there's just this big gap in their knowledge. So when someone tells them their baby is feeding too frequently, it's really common to just think, oh gosh, yes, there must be something wrong here. There must be something wrong with my supply, or, you know, I'm not making good enough milk, et cetera, et cetera. When that could have been fixed with the right knowledge earlier on.
Mm, absolutely. I think there is so many things said to women still about the way that they can do things incorrectly. You often hear people say, you know, that you can spoil the baby, for example. And, you know, what I think people hear and project is their own hang-ups from the decisions that they've made, in particular our own parents, friends, or other female relatives or colleagues that may not have achieved their dream. So they make out that it's ridiculous to believe that it's even possible to breastfeed and succeed at breastfeeding. And they pile all of that onto that person. Oh, well, I didn't manage to do it, so you probably won't either. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I think to some extent, sometimes comes from a place of just wanting to protect the mother in front of you. That I think a lot of women in the past had really distressing breastfeeding experiences. And they're so distressed by it, they want to tell the mother in front of them that it doesn't matter, that it's okay if she doesn't, because they're trying to protect her from that hurt. When actually it can have the opposite effect. She can think that you're dismissing her experiences. You know, she really wants to be able to feed. Generationally as well, we have a big problem because it was only relatively, you know, recent in terms of decades going past that, you know, the advice was to feed your baby to a routine. It was the idea that you should. And if you look at all the baby books that came about in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, they were all about this strict routine feeding. It was best for milk supply, and it got your baby in a routine, and it made sure you didn't spoil them. But what it did was decrease everybody's milk supply and give everybody loads of breastfeeding complications. And then we got the message that, oh gosh, breastfeeding just seems to be too difficult and hard, women can't do it, when actually it was the advice causing them to feel that way. There are some shocking things. My favourite bad advice was a physician from the 1950s called Walter Sackett, who believed that babies should only be fed every 6 hours according to the clock. So 12 o'clock, 6 a.m., 12 p.m., 6 p.m. And then after a couple of weeks or so, you got rid of the night feed. So he really thought you could only breastfeed babies 3 times a day. And we know that would have had a horrific impact upon milk supply if women were actually able to follow it, because we know the more often you feed a baby, the more milk you make, and that breast milk is really easily digested. Babies do feed every 2 hours or so, and they do feed really irregularly. And trying to stop them from feeding when they want to feed, you're probably going to end up with milk supply complications. And that's actually what I ended up doing my PhD on, because I had so many comments about how often my baby fed. I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, I remember a health visitor telling me, and I should point out, this wasn't my regular health visitor. She was wonderful, but it was a locum or one on, you know, who was there when she was away, who said that if my baby fed every 2 hours, I couldn't be making enough milk and he must be hungry. Now, this baby, he was 99th percentile. He had all the rolls down his arms, down his legs. He was round. I remember just looking at her and looking at him and thinking, this is insane. Mm. It is just crazy that people are being given this advice and their confidence being chipped away. So for that PhD, I actually ended up looking at kind of intention, desire to want to breastfeed. And then whether mothers were trying to feed their baby in a routine or not. So whether they were trying to feed to the clock, limit feeds, encourage a baby to feed at a certain time, basically have quite a controlling feeding style to the clock. And if they did, they were far more likely to end up with breastfeeding complications and the low milk supply and stop breastfeeding much earlier than those who are following their baby's cues and feeding whenever they wanted to. But what I also looked at was all the reasons that were influencing that decision to try and feed in this controlling way. And it was all the anxieties over milk supply, that my milk isn't good enough and I must get my baby in a routine. Or people, you know, telling them that you're going to spoil that baby. They're manipulating you, all that stuff. And all the, it was just so sad to see that there was all this external pressure to feed in a certain way, which the mother then felt that she should do because people were telling her, and that was friends, family, health professionals. And she implemented that advice and ended up experiencing loads of pain, difficulties, not making enough milk, having to stop before she was ready, and then grieving that whole process. And I just thought, I have to do something about this. I have to keep on with this research just to try and get the message really out there that this is so damaging. Mm. I think that's where I've ended up, where I am now, kind of fitting in the jigsaws of pieces of that, you know, big puzzle of breastfeeding. But it always comes back to that normal baby behavior, that normal feeding behavior. We need to know it. Mm. We need to know it in pregnancy. We need to know it earlier. It needs to be sort of common knowledge.
So if you could come to my antenatal course and talk to the couples on it, what would you want to say to them?
Oh, gosh. So lots. Have I got all day?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I think an approach where we look at what's normal for baby behaviour first. And I think if you focus on that, then everything else makes sense. So you're looking at why babies wake up so frequently, why they want to be kept close, why they feed so frequently, because they have tiny tummies and breast milk in particular is really easy digested. I'd want them to know then, you know, about responsive feeding, about feeding your baby according to your baby's feeding cues and being able to recognize those and know that, you know, breastfeeding is about more than breast milk. It's about comfort and connection, and that babies feed for all sorts of reasons. And a big one for me is, you know, when people say, oh, you need to give the baby a dummy because they're just comfort feeding, as if just comfort feeding is a bad thing. It's not. It's a way that babies self-regulate and they calm themselves down and they connect. So it's just really they get a lot of comfort from sucking. So that being normal as well. I'd want them to know about all those myths that, you know, are nonsensical, and that feeding your baby responsively will get you the best outcomes. But then I think if you just do that within a little bubble, it can actually be quite damaging, because it makes breastfeeding seem difficult, and it makes it seem like the mother just has to give up everything and her sleep and her well-being. Because obviously the important layer around that is that people close to her should be looking after her. So for partners, it's about ways that they can care for her and ways that they can support her and make things easier for her. And, you know, thinking about all the ways they can make it easier so she can just concentrate on feeding and getting as much rest as possible, and ways they can support caring for their baby in a way that doesn't damage breastfeeding, that doesn't take the baby away from her all day long, but, you know, putting the baby in a sling between feeds so she can sleep, all those sorts of things. And I'd invite partners, but I'd also want you doing sessions for grandparents. I'd also, you know, I think the antenatal session content needs to be taught to teenagers as well. You know, I'd want everybody around her to have this knowledge and information about how we better support women. I'd bring back, you know, that postnatal recovery and rest, and just understanding that we should value and protect and look after our new mothers, not expecting them to be out shopping the day after a baby or out visiting or all of that. Mm. I'd get them to also be able to recognize how breastfeeding is going well, but also complications that might arise. So knowing about thrush and mastitis and all of those relatively common issues, and importantly, where to get support with them.
What seems really important to me with education during antenatal classes is the knowledge that the birth partner gains about feeding. They need to understand that there is no way that they can provide the same level of care to a newborn as the mother, because they're not meant to. And that's okay. Their job is to support. I have a lot of conversations with people, for example, who say, well, I would like to express so that he can do some of the feeding. And I'm not sure whether that comes from a place of kindness. because it seems hard for them if they're not getting the chance to give their baby some milk, as if giving milk is the only thing that the other parent to the child can do. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one thing I'd love to do, and I've tried to get funding for in the past, is do some really intensive antenatal sessions with partners where you train them up with the basic peer support training for breastfeeding. So they're the one who is there at 3 a.m. most of the time. So if they could almost be a first responder as such for, you know, breastfeeding support. So, you know, they could say, ah, it looks like you might have, you know, some thrush going on here. Or no, if you just maybe hold the baby slightly differently, let me help you, etc. So that would be one thing. And then it's about teaching all those ways that you can support feeding without giving the bottle. And I mean, this is a really individual decision, because some couples, they really want to involve express milk. That's perhaps she's really able to express milk easily. She's happy to do that. I mean, there are such huge variations in expressing milk, aren't there? I used to be able to, you know, express a full bottle in about 10 minutes. And it would have been easy if the babies had taken a bottle. It was almost cruel. You know, I could express pretty easily, but they wouldn't drink it. But for some women, it will take hours to get, you know, enough for a feed. And there's all the faff of getting the breast pump and spending the time doing it and cleaning it and everything that's involved, almost like the emotional load of giving a bottle. And it's kind of what I think that you see a lot of the times, that mothers are so wanting their partner to be involved, and the partner really wants to feed because we're told that feeding babies is really nice and important. And, you know, we have so many connotations of food and love, don't we, and connection. But I just see her going through all this emotional load of making sure that the milk is there in the bottle to be fed so that the partner can sit there and feed the baby. And you just think, this is back to front. If you want to be involved in feeding your baby in that way, then you need to step up and do as much of that emotional load as possible and make sure that the mother is having chance to rest and get a break as well. Mm. And it's for individual couples to work out, and different couples will manage things in different ways. But always kind of think about, what are you asking the mother to do if you want to be able to express? Is it and give that baby the bottle? Is it simple? Okay, that might be very different. Or is it going to actually be an additional thing for her to do? What are you going to do for her as a kind of supporting her?
Mm, absolutely. And there are so many other things that babies need rather than just, you know, the feeding side of things. I interviewed somebody recently and he very sweetly said, she was boob woman and I was nappy man. You know, and it might seem really harsh to say, well, you get to change all the nappies, do all the winding, do all of the changing and all of the other things. But there are so many other things to do. And one of them, which I think is really crucial, is to feed her, because one of the things I always talk about on my courses is mental health can go downhill rapidly if there's poor nutrition and lack of sleep. And lack of sleep, you can't really do much about, but poor nutrition, you can. And having the ability to discuss that in pregnancy and talk about, you know, how that becomes a very important part of the birth partner or the postnatal partner or the spouse's role is vital, because, you know, when you walk out that door, assuming you go out to work every day, pandemic would have been more common. Lots more people are working from home now, but when you walk out that door, do you know, have they got a nutritious meal to grab in the 3 seconds that they've got to grab it? Because otherwise you can come home and all she's managed to eat all day is 2 bags of crisps and a bar of chocolate, because they were the only things available that could be grabbed in an instant. So, you know, it's making sure that those discussions and that awareness is taking place, because when a woman's mental health deteriorates, often if you look at those two things, those are the two key issues.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on there. And that could be a really good role, can't it? It could be something you can take quite seriously in making sure she's got lots of stuff she can grab really easily, varied lots of nutrition there. And you know, if you feed the mum, you feed the baby effectively, because you're supporting her to make that milk. Mm. And you know, there are other things you can do, like you can sit and cuddle her whilst she's feeding the baby. You know, you can cuddle up together as long as she's happy with that. She might want you nowhere near her because she's completely touched out. But, you know, sometimes you can just all cuddle up together and it's lovely. You can have your own, you know, special dad sling. And, you know, I don't want to stereotype. I was going to say, you know, like your football slogan sling or something. There's surely a market for that. I think I might just have created a whole new product. But, you know, sometimes different parents like, you know, different slings for because it suits their body shape better. But, you know, you can be the one who does the soothing and the carrying in between those feeds in your sling and takes the baby out for a little walk. Although some mothers, that gives them so much anxiety about being separated. But, you know, bath time, cuddling up, soothing them to sleep. They're all lovely things, you know, that don't have to involve nappies. But there's so much you can do in making things special and having your little routines and traditions and, you know, having special books that you're the one that reads the baby, you know, even if, you know, they're just listening to the sound of your voices. There's so many ways, but looking after the mother is a really, really core role because it will make things better for everybody. Yeah. And I think it's just so, so important. And we need to recognize that partners are absolutely exhausted as well. They can be feeling the weight of the world on their shoulder. Mm. And, you know, it's the common argument, isn't it? You know, I've been at home all day with the baby and I haven't been able to put them down and do anything. And I can't believe you've been out at work and drinking a hot coffee and talking to adults. And the parent who's working is then like, I can't believe you've got to stay at home all day with the baby. So it's about keeping talking through all of this, isn't it? And looking after each other and really sharing that role.
Yeah.
But really realizing in that first 6 to 8 weeks after the birth, it is the mother who's going to have more intensive needs, most likely. I mean, there's going to be huge variations. Some women will bounce back, for want of a better word, really quickly. They might have really good mental health. They're doing really well. But for a lot, we have to recognize that she's recovering and she's exhausted and she's struggling with hormonal changes and all the pressures of what's probably being at home on her own a lot of the time. And, you know, it's such an important role to look after her. And I don't think we stress that as much as a really valuable role. We don't kind of big partners up enough to say, you know, you're doing a really good job with that.
Yeah. I think one thing you touched on, which is really, really important to cover, is the separation anxiety that often women feel that they never expected to feel with the baby. So it's all very well that they are feeling touched out and they really do want you to have the baby. But the minute the baby is out of their arms, they can experience real serious anxiety and lack of trust in you as the partner. And that isn't about you. It isn't that you're doing anything wrong. They can't even put into words why they're feeling that way, but they almost immediately want the baby back to be able to say, no, it's okay, I'll do it. And I think kindness and compassion, if that is the experience that you're having as the partner, if you're witnessing the new mother going through this, don't be mean about it and sort of be snappy and say, you know, oh, for goodness sake, you've just asked me to have the baby, and, you know, now you don't trust what I'm doing, because it isn't something that even she understands. But when you remember that she's a mammal, and we would never dream of separating other mammals who had recently given birth, it kind of makes more sense. It's such a strange time of transition and adjustment. And like you say, some women will just bounce back and others won't. It's a bit of a lottery as to how you will experience those early postnatal weeks. But kindness and compassion is what is really important to get everyone through that time.
I think we forget that in our kind of modern social worlds, where in westernized cultures, where we kind of really push separation, I think we forget just how much instinct and evolutionary behaviour is going on, of a lot of mothers feeling quite panicked when their baby isn't there, because their, you know, their evolutionary brain is telling them that something's happened to the baby, and to keep them close because it's such an instinct. Mm. And I think it's just taking care of each other.
Yeah.
And a big focus is going to be on looking after her so she can look after the baby.
There's such a good point there with the whole mammalian side of things, that women these days are control freaks, aren't they? There's no better way to describe the fact that we just like to feel in control of everything. And, you know, people were telling me 30 years ago, well, babies don't come with instruction manuals. You know, you just have to get on and find your way. And I can remember them saying that to me. But at the same time, when it actually does happen and you do feel like you've lost control and you're feeling a little bit out of control, it's good to remind them and say, this is perfectly normal for you to just go with the flow and follow the baby's cues. We do need reminding of that, I think. Another thing that you mentioned was about the touching and cuddling. I think that a lot of women often feel that if their partner cuddles them, that it might lead to sex, when they're not actually ready to embark on a sexual relationship with their partner so soon after giving birth. And I think a lot of women push their partners away because of that fear, when actually what they should be doing is just communicating how much they want physical contact with their partners, that it just isn't going to lead to sex. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's another area, and it's just, again, kindness and care and responding to your own personal situation in front of you, because, you know, cuddling up and connection really does still increase those levels of oxytocin and the calmness and the bonding with your partner. And there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, look, I love a cuddle, but not quite there yet. And actually just setting out those expectations so you haven't got that kind of misconceptions between you.
Yeah, definitely.
I think as well, just going back to your previous point about the control, and it's really interesting because we did some research a few years ago that looked at who was more likely to want to put their baby in a routine and to want the predictability. And it did tend, I mean, there was variation, but it tended to be the mothers who were having babies later on, mm-hmm. because they'd got more used to having control over their daily lives. They'd got used to often very senior positions in work where they had control and they had routine and they were able to predict. And then this little baby came along and just threw everything into disarray. And it was kind of the shock of how unpredictable it all was, and that suddenly you had to respond to this little baby's cues that kept changing with their development and their sleep patterns, and it just kind of was so anxiety inducing. Whereas the mothers who tended to have babies much younger tended to go with the flow a little bit more because they weren't used to anything different. Mm. So it's again, I think this is just such a key part of antenatal education around what's normal for babies, that they're completely unpredictable, that they're responding according to their needs at the time. And then just some tips around, you know, coping with that and recognizing that it's normal and making sure you've got the support around you, if possible, that allows you just to go with the flow. But expectations is a big part of it. So we talk about those expectations about sex, but, you know, expectations around what state the house is going to be in, and, you know, how unpredictable life is going to be, that I think if you're expecting it to be chaos for a while, that's far easier than making all these careful plans and then being broken. Mm. Because that's when you start spiraling, isn't it, that you think you're doing something wrong because you can't put into place the plan that you wanted. Well, we did some research around the impact of baby care books that told you to put your baby in a strict routine and the impact of not being able to follow that advice. So reading the book, wanting to follow this routine and it not working, really, you know, it left parents feeling frustrated, like a bad mother, out of control, really anxious, because when you're promised that you can do something in a certain way, and it doesn't work, you start blaming yourself that you're not managing this situation correctly, when actually babies are just acting in a completely normal baby way.
Let's talk about your books, because you've written so many amazing books, and some of them are brilliant guides for pregnancy, and some of them might be more appropriate for the postnatal period. Which was your favourite one to write?
Gosh, I'm not sure I can answer that, actually. They're all so different. I love them all. That's like asking me what my favourite child, which one my favourite child is, I think. I think they're all so different, and they are all written in response to a different situation that I kept encountering. So let's talk about The First Year of Parenting, which is my big book, which really tries to cover everything that you might encounter in the postnatal period. So everything from normal emotions around having a baby, recovery after birth, rest, your baby's normal behaviour, physical recovery, emotional recovery, relationships, sex, work, all of that, everything that you kind of might encounter. And I loved writing that because it was almost like a guide to what to expect and what's normal and where to get the support. So that's a lovely one. That's kind of more enjoyable to write. Then you have the books I've written out of anger is probably the wrong word, but frustration and feeling a need to write something to support parents. So my little book on breastfeeding grief and trauma is a really good example of that. It was just written out of meeting so many women with these really challenging experiences who are really grieving not being able to breastfeed. So it's, again, it's a little book that just talks about this is all normal and this is how you might feel and this is what you might do to start your recovery. And a big thing that parents say to me about that one is they're like, how are you writing about my exact situation? How are you in my head? And it's just, it's not that I'm in their head, obviously. It's just that this is so common and I've seen it so often. And I think COVID Babies, my new book, also came from exactly the same place, that it was a need to write about parents' experiences during the pandemic around pregnancy, birth and caring for their baby, that again validated and gave them reassurance that their experience was normal and it was okay to feel so distressed about it. Because a lot has been swept under the carpet there, that so many changes have happened to care and support parents have had, but it's almost like on a higher up policy level, it's all been ignored, that it just doesn't matter because none of it's being recorded sort of officially, because, you know, those individual traumatic experiences and that individual grief just isn't being recognized. So when I shared excerpts of that book, again, people are saying, I don't get how you're in my head. This is my exact experience. You've completely summed up how I'm feeling. How do you know? And it's just like, again, talking to so many parents, reading all the research and realizing how common it is just to feel so distraught by the whole experience. And it's okay to feel that way. Just because you haven't had a major health complication because of COVID doesn't mean you had a really good time.
I was shocked to find out at how much research has been done actually on the experiences of families giving birth during COVID times.
So much. That the book alone, it's a relatively short book. It's about 50,000 words and it's got 434, to be precise, research papers in it. And that's only some of it. There is so much good work that has been done, but it doesn't seem to be reaching the policymakers. It still seems to be ignored. But some of the stats that are coming out, and it's basically that anything negative that happens before seems to have tripled. So the studies are showing that birth trauma has tripled and postnatal depression has tripled and anxiety during pregnancy has tripled. And that's really shocking to me. Why is it not headline news? It's like nobody on a high up level seems to care. I mean, plenty of doulas and health professionals and those counsellors trying to support parents can see it happening. But where has the discussion been in the mass media about how traumatic this has been for parents? It's just there. And where's the discussion around what we're going to do to help them now? So that's why I wrote that book, because I wanted to do something And I knew that I can write books fairly quickly. I know I can write in a way that is readable. So I thought, this is what I can do. I can bring it all together and hopefully get it read by people who can make a difference to all of this.
Yeah. I mean, it's been really difficult supporting families through COVID, but far worse seeing what they went through on the other side. You know, definitely from my perspective, having heard, as you have, about the experiences that women went through and some of the coercion involved, you know, not being able to have your partner with you until you had a vaginal examination to determine how advanced in labour you are, when many women didn't want to have a vaginal examination and shouldn't have had to have one, but were told they didn't have a choice because their partner wouldn't be able to join them if they didn't.
And it being a meaningless measurement, really, as well, in terms of partner joining you, because what does it mean if you're 4 centimetres dilated? You're in active labour. And that doesn't mean you're going to give birth in exactly 2 hours. It doesn't work like that. So yeah. It was just so nonsensical to put the limits on around duration. To me, it just doesn't, you know, surely someone is in the hospital or not. And we know that exposure will occur after a relatively short period of time. So does it matter if they're in there for 6 hours versus 10 hours? I don't understand. Maybe there's a logical reason, because as I point out in the book, I'm not a virologist, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not, you know, a health professional. Maybe someone can explain what the logical reason is there.
Yeah, especially when that person's just dropped them off anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
And is now been made to sit in the car freezing cold for 6 hours waiting for their queue to go in and join them. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all. Well, I'm really excited to read your book. I know it's just come out, hasn't it?
Yes, last week. So you can get some signed copy from me. It should hopefully be available on Amazon by the time you're listening to this. There have been some logistical issues plus some Amazon issues, which means that they're giving a very late date of something like mid-January, when actually it should actually be out now. But there we go. But you could also get the Kindle and the audiobook. I've actually been recommending the audiobook to women who feel quite distressed by the situation. And you know, I've said that I don't think there's any evidence necessarily behind this. But to me, sometimes someone reading it to you might be easier to sort of listen to and process compared to having to read it. Mm. It's probably different people enjoy and learn in different ways. But to me, it can sometimes be easier to listen to something rather than have to read it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you can listen to it when you've got your children around, whereas you can't always hold a book when you've got your children
around. Or you can, you know, you can escape for a walk with the baby pushing them and listen as you walk along. So yeah
absolutely. Well done. I think all of your books are amazing, and I have a lot of them. I would just like to ask you one last question. And that is, what top tips can you give to any birth partners listening about supporting a pregnant woman or person or postnatal woman or person during this time?
I think the key one would be to look after her. Look after her during pregnancy, look after her during birth. That's your role. And that's such an important role and a way of looking after your baby. And I think it's also to remember that even though when you're in that newborn period and it seems so intense and seems like it's going to last forever, your baby is going to rapidly change. So even though they might seem to completely be attached to her now, that's going to change really, really quickly. And your baby's going to start interacting with you in different ways as you both, you know, develop that relationship together. Mm-hmm. Children, you know, are for a long time. There's plenty of opportunity to really form that bond.
Absolutely.
And at the moment, you know, everything you can do to look after her actually will strengthen your bond with your baby.
I teach baby massage classes, and you can see the women with the 4, 5, 6 week olds. They're all sat there with the babies attached to them permanently. And then they can look across the room and see the women with the 11, 12 week olds who are lying on the floor, kicking their legs. And I'll say, you see, it doesn't last forever. It's only such a small window. And these babies want to be free to roam and explore their worlds and to develop all of these wonderful skills that they're going to. You just need to remember this is a very small period of time that will end. So try and perceive it to be an enjoyable time, because the more you can do that, the easier you find it. If you're too busy trying to get them to go in the basket in the corner of the room, because that's what you think they should be doing, sleeping really well on their own, that's when you will have a much more difficult experience, because you will be trying to force something that just won't happen easily. And it just makes it a lot harder for all concerned, because they wonder why the baby cries so much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, nothing lasts forever, does it? It's whatever is happening at the moment will pass. It'll probably be replaced by something different. Yeah. But, you know, whatever you're going through now is not going to last forever.
No. But equally finding your own parenting philosophy within that, I suppose, isn't it? It's about being true to yourselves as a couple and not worrying about what your friends are doing and how they're raising their children. That's another thing.
Yeah, that's always a challenging one, isn't it? It's just about realizing that you're doing what's best for you in your circumstances, and everybody's circumstances are complicated and different. And, you know, everyone's doing the best for their baby. It just might look slightly different sometimes.
Exactly. Thank you so much for coming on today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
I have too. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner with me, Sally Ann Beresford. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review and don't forget to hit subscribe. If you are on Instagram, you will find me at The Ultimate Birth Partner. Please feel free to follow me for more ideas on supporting women through the birth of a baby. If you would like to purchase a copy of the book that accompanies this podcast, then head over to Amazon and type in Labour of Love, The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner. If you would like to work with me on a one-to-one basis, visit my website www.birthability.co.uk or email me hello@birthability.co.uk.